Hola, futuro listener. I wanted to hop on here at the top of our show to let you know that today's programming is going to be a little bit different than what we normally do. And that's both for Latino USA and our podcast In the Thick. And that's because on this very special episode, our shows are teaming up and we're bringing you midterm election coverage, futuro media style, which you know is our style. So my In the Thick co-host, Julio Ricardo Varela, is joining me for this one. Hey, Julio.
Hey, Maria.
And we're super excited for this little experiment of ours. So let's get started. From Futuro Media and PRX, a first-time election collaboration between Latino USA
and In the Thick. A podcast about politics, race, and culture.
I'm Maria Hinojosa.
And I'm Julio Ricardo Varela.
Today, we're breaking down the 2022 midterms and what the election results mean to our listeners and Latinos and Latinas across the country. So, first things first, there was no so-called red wave on November 8th. You all saw that. Despite all the speculation ahead of the elections that Republicans would easily oust Democrats from offices across the country, the electorate didn't deliver the landslide victories that the GOP expected and fed to the media. And again, it's not that simple because it never is.
Right. And Democrats actually exceeded expectations, although, to be honest, mostly because those expectations were quite low. In the battle to determine which party would control the Senate and the House, contests across the country were neck and neck, a lot of close races. But by the weekend following the election, the victory by Catherine Cortez Masto in Nevada secured the Senate for Democrats. Other close races are still being decided to determine control of the House of Representatives. Voters rallied around abortion rights, delivering decisive victories to pro-choice candidates and policy proposals. And young people, they came out in significant numbers, a resounding reminder that the future is coming, and it is Latino and Latina, whether or not party establishment is ready for it.
The country's demographics are dramatically shifting away from an older white majority. We're processing major events like a pandemic, a painful period of high inflation, along with paradigm-shifting decisions that are handed down by a conservative majority in the Supreme Court. So, in order to understand what's happening, we decided to reach out to the voters directly. Ahead of Election Day, we asked our Latino USA and our In the Thick listeners to call us with their thoughts about the midterms, because we believe you have voice and agency. So here we go.
I have three girls, and I just have to make sure that I am providing the best future for them. So I have to do my part in voting.
I do feel a responsibility to be an activist in immigration and helping undocumented immigrants in my state.
I just feel the mishandling of the economy, the lack of focus on America is not right, you know.
We're super grateful because let me tell you, so many of you, in fact, yes, you did. You picked up the phone and you called. Like I said, rotary, dial it the rotary style. We got you.
Yeah.
In particular this year, I'm extra moved because of Roe v. Wade.
I moved to vote because of crime and the transgender woke thing going on in the schools.
And the main issues at this point is voter suppression. Anybody who promotes voter suppression will never receive my vote.
We wanted to hear from you, dear listener. Exactly what do you care about? What do you think is your part in the election process? What do you think about your political candidates?
I'm a former Democratic Party activist, but I want more from them.
No es por quien estoy votando. Yo estoy votando against Donald Trump.
If I vote for any party, it's going to be the party in favor of the citizens.
I mean, I'm thinking about running for local governor, honestly, because this is ridiculous because our candidates are trash.
Different communities around the United States, they have unique priorities in politics. And then when it comes to the quote-unquote Latino vote, it's really unpredictable and complex We know that as well. But thanks to your calls, we heard from people from all over the country, not only New York City, but Columbus, Ohio, San Antonio, Texas, and Menlo Park, California.
I live in Tulsa and Oklahoma.
I live in Oregon, and I voted almost 2 weeks ago.
I am an Afro-Latina living in the state of Arizona.
I'm calling from Concord, California.
From Madison, Wisconsin.
From North Carolina.
Chicago, Illinois.
Simsbury, Simsbury, Connecticut.
And judging from these calls, people were fired up.
You know what? And that for us as political junkies, journalists who really love to talk about democracy, at all hours, that's the way Julio and I do it. Because here's the thing. That's what we want and what we need for Latino and Latina voters, right?
Right.
Need to be talking politics all the time at the dinner table, breakfast table, lunch table. It's true. Because, look, let's be real. Midterms are not the sexiest elections. There's no battle for a presidential seat. Local and state elections aren't always going to get national attention. But really, the midterms have such consequences. So, previous midterm elections, like 2018, had the highest voter turnout during a midterm year in four decades. 2018, remember that?
Wow. Yeah.
Even then, the Census Bureau said that only about half of all eligible voters in the United States cast a ballot, which is a challenge to us. If we're going to say we're the world's greatest democracy, we kind of got to show up.
Right. 2022, the turnout was a little bit less than 2018 overall. And according to exit polls, 60% of all voters identified as Latino, only second to white voters. And every 6 in 10 gave their vote to Democrats.
My mantra, if you've been listening to In the Thick, is repeating over and over again that Latinos and Latinas make up the second largest voting cohort in the United States. You just heard the data. So the people who did make it to the polls this year really had a sense of urgency, right? And this was an election that really took on issues that are very personal. For example, women's rights and access to legal and safe abortion.
I plan on voting a Democratic ticket simply because I believe in women's rights and the women's rights to choose. And there is no way I would ever stay home and not vote.
Issues like the economy, central to Latino and Latina voters.
My priority for this country, the country I fought for and served, is the economy, which is devastated. And I'm not a Trump addict or whatever. I just do believe that right now there has to be changes.
Gun legislation.
I am calling from Harris County in Texas. That's in the Houston area. And it is unfathomable to me that Greg Abbott has done nothing to keep kids and teachers safer in schools.
Climate change.
Climate change is the critical thing that I feel people need to talk about the most, because none of the other topics really are going to matter if we don't take care of our earth.
And yes, even misinformation.
What is moving me to vote? First of all of these lies that the Republican Party have told, you name it, they come with a cornucopia of innuendos, half-truths, just blatant lies.
Overall, people said that they were losing faith in political parties. And this is problematic for our democracy, right?
Yeah.
Republicans were dishonest propagandists, too extreme in their views. Democrats, some said, were quote unquote too woke or not progressive enough. But one of the biggest concerns for our callers was the very fabric of our political system. And I have to say, it's kind of terrifying, right? Yeah. We're seeing the value and importance of our vote play out in real time, all while realizing and understanding, in fact, how fragile the democracy in the United States really is.
I want to vote against every Republican that is an election denier. We have to stand up for democracy before party.
Yo pienso que la democracia está en juego. Y yo pienso que tenemos que defender esa democracia a toda costa.
I care about our democracy. I care about the future for our children. And I'm very worried that people are taking our democracy for granted.
In this episode, we're going to talk through some of the key results, what they might tell us about Latino voters at this moment, and most of all, how they impact you, dear listener. So, our callers, all of the voices that we heard from, they've already voted, right? Whether by mail or in person or during early voting.
And full disclosure, most of the calls we got were from folks who identified as Democrats or leaning Democrat. And we mostly heard from Latinos and Latinas in both English and in Espanol. And this wasn't part of any poll, though here at Futuro Media, we did release our first ever political poll last month, which you can check out at Futuro's Latino Rebels website. I gotta say, now that the dust has settled, Maria, our findings were pretty accurate. Even after stunts like sending Venezuelan migrants to Martha's Vineyard earlier this year, incumbent Florida Governor Ron DeSantis easily had the highest favorability rating among Latinos in the state. DeSantis won re-election pretty handily, with 60% of the vote, including 57% of the Florida Latino vote, and that guy's a big-time Republican.
We will never, ever surrender to the woke mob. Florida is where woke goes to die.
But in Florida, big news. We saw Maxwell Alejandro Frost, a 25-year-old Afro-Cuban progressive, become the first ever Gen Z member of Congress.
I think this win shows the country, don't count us out. Don't count out young people.
Right. And there were also other firsts for Latinos and Latinas. For example, in California, two Democrats made history. Alex Padilla became California's first elected Latino senator. And Robert Garcia is said to be the first openly queer immigrant Congress member. Delia Ramirez, a Democrat from Illinois, became the first Latina from the Midwest ever elected to Congress.
A woman, pregnant, crossed that border, nearly drowned, so that her firstborn, me, could be born in this country. She now goes to Congress. It's emotional, and it's real.
In 2022, wow.
I'm a Chicago girl, so hello, Illinois. And again, the headlines keep on coming. In the South now, there's a Senate runoff in Georgia between Republican candidate Herschel Walker and incumbent Reverend Raphael Warnock, with a vote that's scheduled for December 6th. Meanwhile, Stacey Abrams lost in the race for governor, prompted a lot of questions about racism and misogyny in politics. And interestingly, Stacey Abrams, her whole plan is about reaching voters that don't feel like they've been reached out to. In a state like Georgia, that means everything with the runoff that's coming up.
Look, I got into this race for one reason and one reason only, to fight. And not just any fight, a fight to save Georgia.
And in Texas, Governor Greg Abbott, he defeated challenger Beto O'Rourke. But several counties in South Texas did go Democratic, particularly two in the Rio Grande Valley. So in a state that is now majority Latino, it is a detail that could be telling for future elections.
Also, the right to abortion prevailed unanimously. It became enshrined in the state constitutions of Vermont, California, and Michigan, while voters rejected proposals limiting abortion access in Kentucky and in Montana. So let's get to it. To help us break down what happened in these midterms and to make sense of what happens next, we're hosting our very own post-elections roundtable. Joining us from Washington, D.C. is Cristian Paz. He's senior politics reporter for Vox. Welcome back, Cristian.
Thank you. Gracias. Very happy to be here.
And joining us from Atlanta, Georgia is Maya King, politics reporter for the New York Times covering the South. Welcome to the show, Maya.
Hi. Thank you for having me. I'm so excited to be here.
And listener, we're keeping you in the conversation. We're going to be playing more of these voicemails that you sent to us throughout our episodes. So stay tuned. So real quick thing that we do here on In the Thick is that we like to do a temperature check. So what's your emotional state? Not your journalist state, like your emotional state. Maya, what's your temperature check? How you doing?
On a scale of 1 to 10, I think I'm about an 8.5. I actually got some sleep over the weekend.
Right.
I just texted my cousin to make plans for our Thanksgiving, so I'm thinking about food and sleep. So I'm feeling pretty good, but I know that I also have about 3 more weeks of campaign coverage ahead of me.
True, true. It is not over. If you were like, it's over, it's not over. Yeah. Okay, that's great. Cristian, you get some sleep? What's your temperature check? Tell us.
Yeah, I think I'm doing pretty well. I had a wonderful Friendsgiving. That was like the thing I was looking forward to after
nice.
Pretty crazy last few weeks. And yeah, Thanksgiving's coming up, favorite holiday. on a scale of 1 to 10, like Maya, I would probably also say around an 8. Like, I did get some sleep, and now it's all about seeing what takes are left to deliver with the time that we have.
I love the fact, Maria, that both Maya and Christian were like, I can't wait to eat a lot of food next week.
Yes. I need a turkey-induced nap.
Because when you're on the road, you eat terrible stuff. Mm-hmm. Julio, what is your temperature check?
Maria, I'm great. We had this conversation on Friday. I think this raises a lot of questions about where this country goes next. And there is a little bit of hope. And I'm sorry I was so cynical the last couple of years. My bad. I'm going to come back with a little hope. How's that?
I think that's a good thing.
Yeah. Everyone's like, okay.
And you know what? I'm just going to combine everything that you all said. I did get some sleep, which is really important. I did get some exercise. I was boxing. So that was good. And like Julio, I believe that democracy won in these midterms.
Yeah.
I think writ large, democracy won. I think it's a very complicated message for the Republican Party and for the Donald Trump wing of the Republican Party. And I think that there are a lot of positives in terms of Latino and Latina voters. And so we're going to talk about that and a lot more. And we're just going to dive into the results.
Let's dive in,
right?
Maria.
Okay. So Democrats did reach the 50-member threshold needed to hold on to their majority in the Senate after incumbent Catherine Cortez Masto, by the way, the country's first Latina senator, won her seat in Nevada. Mark Kelly also won in Arizona, so that put them at the majority. Control of the House of Representatives, on the other hand, is still up in the air. It's increasingly looking like whichever party gains a majority will only have it by a few seats, but it's still in play.
Yeah.
Both in Arizona and in Nevada, Latino and Latina voters were key. We've been saying that Latino and Latina voters were key in terms of these victories for democracy and for the Democratic Party.
Yep.
An NBC News exit poll showed that while Latinos made up only 12% of Nevada voters, 62% of those who did turn out voted for Cortez Masto. Now, that's big, 62%. Likewise, Mark Kelly carried the Latino electorate in Arizona by 18 points. But Cortez Masto had a very, very close race. Some of this is in part attributed to the Democratic establishment not investing enough in what's happening in the state. So, Maya, we're seeing Democrats repeatedly take Black and brown voters for granted. And yet, hello, yet again, it is these voters that are getting them across the finish line. And then, of course, there's all of the attention focusing on the Georgia Senate runoffs next month between Democrat Reverend Raphael Warnock and Republican Herschel Walker. So do you think that this is going to impact the party's priorities in the next legislative session? What's your take when you just saw this and you're just like, okay, Democrats, open your eyes?
Yeah. The overarching theme, I think, of the last 2 years of Democratic leadership in Washington has been promises that were made, but perhaps not really delivered on for people of color, for Black and Latino voters in particular. And I think that was a fear or a concern among a number of operatives going into this midterm cycle, whether their voters of color, who they absolutely rely on, would sort of take stock of how their lives have changed or haven't, and maybe vote accordingly. And on the other side, you have Republicans who are delivering this message over and over again that Democrats have not delivered for Black and brown communities. And they use that message to try to make inroads, particularly with Black men in Georgia.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Now, whether or not that bodes anything for the Senate runoffs in December, I'm not sure if this is front of mind for voters. I think the big thing, particularly for Black voters in Georgia, is the issue of candidate quality. Raphael Warnock and Herschel Walker could not be any more different.
Mm.
And in fact, for Walker, I think he represents some of the worst stereotypes that Black Southerners feel white folks harbor against them, that he is very athletic, that he is not extremely articulate in the way that he tries to talk about his policy points, that he has a history of violence, that he may not be very active in his children's lives. I mean, these are all the things that I've heard a lot of Black folks talk to me about and say, this is not a representative of us in the way that Warnock, the senior pastor of Ebenezer Baptist Church, is.
Mm-hmm.
I just threw a lot at you in one answer. But you know, I think that Democrats have their work cut out for them, particularly in the next 2 years, to deliver something for Black and brown voters in 2024, which is arguably an even more treacherous political landscape. But in the more immediate term, the focus for those voters here in Georgia is getting Raphael Warnock across the finish line.
Hmm. All right. And that's like the entire country is like zeroing in on the state of Georgia. I think that's fascinating. Christian, you were covering Nevada. So the results, I mean, it was so tight. What do you see in terms of the results and what you were hearing on the ground? Take us to Nevada.
Yeah. So imagine you're in Nevada. It's a lovely state with two big counties where most of the population lives. So Washoe up north where Reno is and Clark County where Las Vegas is, where like 75% of the population lives. When you were there during the COVID shutdowns, the economy really took a giant hit there. And now you're looking at your options in the midterm elections and you're wondering, do you want more of the same? Do you want to shake it up? And now you get to election day. Things are looking really bad in terms of inflation. Things are looking bad in terms of who the president is. You're kind of frustrated with your governor, Steve Sisolak. You're frustrated with the president. And you're talking to Catherine Cortez Masto. And her pitch to you is, I'm not a crazy person. I'm a very normal, hardworking person. Things are bad because some things are out of our control. Some things that I advocated against maybe contributed to inflation. Maybe crime is up. Maybe it's not. There was a big debate in national media about whether this was going to be a referendum on the Democrats or if it was going to be a choice. And it came down to being a choice. And most of the people who turned out were not willing to go with the riskier choice when it came to the Senate election. You know, Nevada is a third Democratic, a third nonpartisan, and a third Republican. And then that nonpartisan wing turned out very heavily. And they chose the Democratic candidate.
Yeah.
And Republicans who turned out also made different, you know, they made split choices too. They might have voted for Lombardo for the governor, but they looked at Laxalt and thought too much and voted for Cortez Masto. And you do see that wide appeal there coming out.
Christian, can I just ask you this? You're right. Like in terms of a national appeal, Catherine Cortez Masto is the person who keeps her head down. She's the Latina who, you know, se va a trabajar.
Mm-hmm.
But
lays it down a little bit, no?
So what about that? Because this is all what politicians do, right? Like if you are the first Latina senator, you know, you're in that space, you're owning that space.
Yeah.
You're, I mean, to me, politicians have to know how to communicate to the masses, how to frankly rev them up. This is part of their job. And I feel a little bad saying it, but then again, we're honest on this show. It's like, le falta un poquito de fuego. It's like there's a fire.
She can't just go to Bad Bunny concerts like, you know, 6 weeks before the election. You guys all saw that, right?
Correct.
You know what I mean?
Correct. Mm-hmm. So one, am I wrong? Should I really just be like, well, that's ridiculous. Look at the turnout, which again, it was very tight.
Yeah.
So what are your takes on that?
I don't think that's wrong at all. I've talked to her many times, both during the campaign season and just in her official capacity as a senator. She's not the kind of person that you would feel you'd ride into battle for. You know, there are some politicians who, I mean, Trump famously, who have this personality that attracts people and riles them up. She's not like that. And even when I would talk to her about abortion rights and about Roe, you would sense, you would hear some of that passion there because she is a strong pro-choice, pro-abortion rights defender. And she told me many times, I'm going to make this central to my campaign. But even when I would follow her or talk to her and ask her about her identity, there was a very careful communication of, you know, how she saw herself, how others perceive her, how others might perceive her, and what she needed to do to kind of close that gap. Because, you know, in 2016, when she ran for office, she wasn't running on, you know, the idea that I'm going to be the first Latina, that you should vote for me because you identify with me, I identify with you. She was running another tight race then against Joe Heck, a Republican congressman from the Clark County area. And she definitely had to you know, play up that element of her identity in the closing weeks of that campaign. And we have some similarities here, too. She definitely made a bigger deal this cycle that she was, as the posters would say in Las Vegas and other, you know, campaign events, una de las nuestras, you know, she's one of us, was the idea. She needed that message because, and I asked her about this, she's gotten some criticism in 2016 about why she didn't speak Spanish. If she was Latina, you would assume, especially in the Southwest, Mexican-American heavy, that you'd speak Spanish, that you'd talk to people. And she was asked about this in other interviews as well. And she said, I don't speak Spanish necessarily. I understand it. And I grew up in a household where it was spoken, but it wasn't necessarily the core priority for us to assimilate and fit in our family to, you know, fit into this very, very white culture where her dad and her grandparents were living.
I don't forget where I come from. I have a grandfather who came from Chihuahua, Mexico, to this country for a better life. Grandmother from Las Cruces, New Mexico. And they worked hard. They worked hard, and my parents worked hard in this community growing up here to support our family. It is the story of so many Latino families across our state. It's the story of so many Latino families across the country, right? Right. I know my family, not only those that are here today, but those that have passed, would be so proud to see me serving as the first Latina in the U.S. Senate. But even prouder to see me reelected. I will continue to fight for our Latino community.
But she would always go back to some of these cultural signifiers, whether it was La Virgen de Guadalupe and seeing her in her grandmother's home, or the fact that because she had came from two families with immigrant backgrounds, Italian and Mexican, that she was at a crossroads there, where she, I heard this so many times, that she would have Sunday dinners with her Italian side of the family, but then help her grandmother and the Mexican side of her family when it came to
Don't knock the Italian Latinos out there, says an Italian Latino.
No,
you know,
totally.
I'm Bronx Italian, Puerto Rican, so I'm just, you know.
100%.
You know, you eat well on both sides of the table every Sunday, so.
Oh, believe you me, I was getting very jealous. But it was nice to hear her talk about that, because there are those elements that, you know, maybe I have family members who might not necessarily want to speak Spanish or know how to speak it well, but that doesn't make them any less Latino. And that was kind of what she was getting at, that she comes from a community. She has this background.
Yeah. So to bring you into this, Maya, you know, one of the things talking about the Latino community nationally in the midterms, obviously there was a lot of attention given to Florida Governor Ron DeSantis and him winning Miami-Dade and, you know, the big red sweep of Florida and Latinos going for Marco Rubio as senator. And then there was a lot of focus on Texas, right? There was this talk about that Republicans would win the three House seats in the Rio Grande Valley, and they only won one, you know, and also Governor Greg Abbott was reelected even after his refusal to put laws to address gun violence after the mass shooting in Uvalde, which is a predominantly Latino community. And in his victory speech, Abbott already called for anti-immigrant policies.
The new Republican Congress has promised to do their job to secure the border. We must hold them to their promise. They must reinstate the Remain in Mexico policy and go back to building our border wall.
When you look at places like Texas and Florida with Latinos, with other communities like, you know, Black voters, Asian voters, Indigenous voters, they're still heavily Latino states. Now that you have these governors with such radical views and rhetoric, do you think like that will continue to play in these two states? And are Texas and Florida sort of the outliers of the Latino vote?
It's interesting. You know, we came into this midterm cycle expecting a red wave, expecting a total domination of Republicans. And part of that calculus that we heard from a lot of conservatives are these broad inroads that Republicans felt they had made with Latinos. But what came to pass was not quite, certainly not the red wave that we saw, and not, you know, major inroads with Latinos in that, in a way that was super meaningful for the GOP to be able to say, we can lay claim to this group of people, which would be unfair, one, because we already know how diverse Latinos are as a voting bloc. They don't all vote the same.
Exactly.
And as a native Floridian, I'll also say that DeSantis's resounding victory in that state, particularly with Latinos, I think one is a reflection in part of a message that might resonate with a lot of Latino communities, particularly in South Florida, but also in a weakness of Democratic organizing in that state.
Correct.
Because I can also remember the days when Florida was very much in play.
Correct. It's like you're walking away from a political fight. And what is politics,
right?
Especially electoral politics, if not a fight? It's like, why do you walk away? I mean, I'm a boxer. I just don't get it.
You're a boxer. Exactly. What are you? Your creed? Michael B. Jordan? No, Maya, but I think that point that you make about, and in the last 10 years, and this is not some surprise reporting, you talk to many operatives in Florida who've worked on these campaigns, they have said that Democrats sort of missed the opportunity with this community. Is that what you get from being a native Floridian and also a politics reporter?
Certainly. And it's not as if these voters have just left the state, that they've just somehow disappeared. I think that Democrats have left those voters on the table. Republicans are running away, in Florida in particular, saying our message is the message that resonates with the largest number of Latinos and immigrants of color in general in Florida. And we know, just doing the reporting and talking to people on the ground, that that is not entirely the case.
Right.
However, we also know that Democrats have not quite pushed back hard enough with a message and an organizing infrastructure that is strong enough for them to be back in play in Florida. And so I think Georgia, to get back to the...
back to the runoff, but I think you're absolutely right. Bring it back to Georgia.
I mean, just because this is where I've lived and for the last 9 months and spent so much time, I think that Georgia Democrats will have some lessons to take from Florida. The demographics are very different and the dynamics are very different, but you have a large number of Latinos, especially in the Atlanta suburbs, who are still very much in play and I think are actively seeking a strong enough message to be able to coalesce behind a party or a candidate en masse, and not just a month or a few weeks before an election. And you also have an organizing infrastructure in place that, after some serious losses up and down the ballot, you know, Democrats are going to have to do a little bit of recalibration.
Yeah.
And so making sure that the next coalition that they build for 2024 is strong enough to sustain some substantial headwinds from the GOP in Georgia.
Yeah. Well, Christian, I want to bring you into this, but here are my theory. You ready for my theory?
Yeah, let's go.
All right, let's go. So if we consider Florida and Texas to be sort of the Latino outliers, and then you look at the Southwest and the West that have become more bluish, right? Mm-hmm. You look at, you know, Arizona and Nevada and Colorado and all those other states. What's your take on this? Because you've actually written about this in the past. Mm. Are Democrats sophisticated enough to understand how complex the Latino voting electorate is? Because then if you take places like the Northeast or Pennsylvania, where Latinos did play a role in those wins. How do you start breaking this down, given the Florida and Texas context, which I do think takes a lot of air in the room? Your thoughts?
It definitely takes up a lot of air, and this is true in political media, it's true of political campaigns, but a bit of a misunderstanding or simply not wanting to understand just how different the West and Southwest can be and how much potential and hope there is for Democrats, especially there. There is a chance at, you know, having that nuanced understanding, and some of it comes from simply elevating people in those organizations who have that understanding and want to maybe change some of the strategy, or giving new voices power and money to be able to do that, because so much of it, you know, you can have a seat at the table, but if you don't actually have like a chair and something to say, doesn't really matter. But yeah, you look at the Southwest and you have an electorate that is very, very different in that it is predominantly Mexican-American.
Exactly.
Those populations have years of experience with oppression, with, you know, discrimination, with very, very aggressive and in some cases very bigoted politicians attacking them at the state and local level, and a response of organizing by a very young cohort of people who are now in elected office and bringing behind them even younger people who are entering into the electorate. And these are folks who are just much more willing to listen to a Democratic message to begin with, because it's Democrats who've been along with them and fighting back against some of that discrimination. And so you have a population that's also incredibly young still, that has opportunities to be talked to and to be engaged. Mm-hmm, so I guess the question of whether Democrats are able to, they are able to engage those people. Mm-hmm. It is a question of will they? And will they elevate some of those voices that know how to talk to the nuances there?
Mm. I mean, they are a political party that has been part of the United States, for a very long time.
For a very, very long time.
So you're right. The story is right there in front of them. You know, we continue to talk about why don't they do that? You know, because they are walking away from something. All right. Talk about walking into something. We're going to talk about walking right into Georgia.
All right.
Where it's like literally the whole world is watching Georgia. We talked about the Senate runoff election that's coming up next month, and that's the reason why poor Maya doesn't get a break. So neither Reverend Raphael Warnock nor Herschel Walker received more than 50% of the vote. It was super tight. So the gubernatorial election between Republican Brian Kemp and Stacey Abrams, what we did see here was that many voters split their ballot, right? Choosing the Democrat, Warnock, for senator, but then choosing the Republican Party, Kemp, for governor. So Maya, can you break down the Stacey Abrams kind of, everybody's talking about, well, she should just walk away. She lost again. It's over. Can you talk, Maya, about racism and or sexism? Or, you know, when I look at the numbers for Latino men and women, she got 55%. What happened there?
This is a question with so many different facets, but I'll break it down in a few. It starts with the message that Abrams and her campaign put forth in 2018. A little bit more subtly, but it was certainly there. And that is, this is a Black woman born and raised in the Deep South running for an office that has long been occupied mainly by white men, and never a Black woman in a state that has never seen anything like this before, in the Deep South state of Georgia. She was doing that, sort of changing or trying to change the face of leadership while also trying to change the electorate and change the makeup of the electorate. One, to prove to national Democrats that the Deep South is still in play for them, but also to create an electorate that she and other Democrats in Georgia would be able to win in. But we see the outcome again in this 2022 midterm with some of the figures that you point out, that that face of leadership really, frankly, there were some people in Georgia who just didn't agree with her on the substance of her policy. But I mean, I think it's absolutely fair to say there were also some voters who still harbored prejudices and just could not picture a Black woman as the governor of Georgia. It's also hard, though, from a political sort of strategy standpoint, to run against an incumbent who is constantly, constantly vilifying you.
From Futuro Media and PRX, Latino Rebels Radio is an award-winning OG Latino podcast covering stories of the Latino experience that matter in the United States, the Caribbean, Central America, South America, and even parts of the universe. Lo que sea. Created for, about, and by Latinos, join us every Thursday by subscribing to Latino Rebels Radio, wherever you get your podcasts.
So I was undocumented growing up here in the United States. And when I was about 13 or 14, I became politically active. And I have been involved with every presidential election since John Kerry, I believe, in high school. And let me tell you, this is the least involved I've been in an election my whole life. I am now 39 years old. These politicians do not deserve our vote. They definitely have taken advantage of the Latino vote, the Latino support. They take us for granted. And I am reluctantly voting straight Democrat ticket due to the fact that there's no way I will ever vote for a Republican. We need to either take over the Democratic Party and really stand for what we believe in, or we need to form our own third party that better serves our needs. Both of those seem highly unlikely with all those old-ass geriatric-ass fools running the party. So, unfortunately, I am voting straight Democrat. My name is Brianna, and yes, I am no longer undocumented, so I guess I'm voting for people that can't vote, but I don't know. This does not seem like a democracy to me.
All right, so obviously young people played a big role in the midterms. So millennials and Gen Z are on track to be the largest voting bloc in the country by 2024. And in this election, they voted overwhelmingly for Democrats. So according to Tisch College of Civic Life in Tufts University, it estimated that 27% of eligible voters between 18 to 29 years old showed up, which is still quite low.
So low.
27% is still quite low. 63% of them voted for Democrats. Across the board, there are certain issues that Gen Z voters on both sides of the aisle are more likely to acknowledge, like racial justice and climate change. Already in this election, we saw how young voters shaped elections in key battleground states. So, Christian, how do you see younger Gen Z voters shaping future elections? And do you think their approach to policy will push both parties to be more progressive?
Yeah, this kind of goes back a little bit to what I've talked about the Southwest and the future that Democrats have there, because it's Latino and Black and Asian American young voters and young people who in many, many states in the Sun Belt already make up like the majority of Gen Z and of the younger vote that will eventually enter the electorate. And it is true that they in general are more progressive or are more open to progressive ideas.
Yeah.
The problem is that a lot of folks, this is getting back to the vibes part of the election.
Oh, there's a vibes part.
There's a vibes part.
I like this. Okay.
It doesn't get captured in polling, but there is, you know, dissatisfaction, disaffection with electoral politics in general. And this is true of young people in general across previous generations, like when the baby boomers were young and when Gen X were considered the young voters. It's just a nature of youth disaffection with politics. It's gotten more, I guess the stakes have gotten more existential this time around because of things like climate change being actual very, very real concerns for young people and actual being a very big problem objectively.
Yeah.
You know, climate change, abortion rights, when it comes to marijuana legalization, those are things that young people will turn out for. You point to Michigan, a perfect example of a state where the legislature, the governor's office, a referendum were key ways to defend abortion rights because they were under attack at every level in that state. You know, we're seeing a little bit less of the power of candidate versus issue, issue being a little bit more of a motivating thing than a particular candidate is. Mm-hmm. And so that's one way to get to young people, talk about the issues and how those affect you in everyday life. And this is incumbent on, you know, politicians to explain to young people why they are limited within the current system. And that's, you know, there's a saying in politics, right? If you're explaining, you're losing. Don't wait until you have to be losing to begin explaining.
Interesting.
And I'll just add very quickly, I really don't think we can overstate how important the Dobbs decision was over the summer.
Well, in fact, Maya, that was, you just gave me the segue because that was going to be the question.
Yeah.
So the question is, and I actually said this, Maya, I said, look, this will probably backfire. As we say in Mexican Spanish, le va a salir el tiro por la culata. It backfired, in fact, because it inspired young voters, women voters. The numbers are coming in. But yes, when Roe v. Wade was overturned, there was a lot of outrage. And in a sense, when we've said this too, that a lot of the media run by men actually have a problem talking about abortion. And so the conversation was focusing more on inflation and gas prices. But it really seems that young people, women, people who care about abortion rights in general, did not forget. It was front and center. And several of our listeners called in when we did our call-in, citing abortion as the main reason for voting. So, Maya, why do you think the media overlooked the impact that something as personal, frankly, and as political, and as such an important part of American women's history, why is it overlooked in terms of the impact that it has on elections?
I think a challenge for some political reporters, and I'll include myself in this number because I think I made this mistake too, is we thought that Dobbs was going to kind of reach its apex over the summer and then in that post-Labor Day rush get lost in the mix of many other issues, namely the economy. But what we didn't account for was the way that would change the electorate in terms of the explosive turnout that we saw from women and I think a little bit unexpectedly from younger people. And that, I believe we can draw a straight line from the Dobbs decision over the summer to that level of turnout and that shift in the electorate, where you saw so many people saying, I didn't really feel that I needed to vote this year. A lot of people who don't normally historically vote in midterms really couching their entire vote in their concerns about an increasingly radicalized Republican Party and a Supreme Court that is starting to make decisions about their bodies, doing things that are out of their control.
One of the big takeaways from this election is that we can't rely on polling 100%. Many big media organizations reported on these GOP-led claims of a red wave, which didn't really happen. It just didn't happen. And then you add the misinformation about voting, of which Latinos are a big target. So if people are being told that the election is a wash or one party will sweep, they may become de-incentivized from voting. So Christian, what lessons do we as journalists have to carry from this in covering future elections, especially now that it's very likely that Trump is still a factor in 2024, right?
Yeah, there's a lot to unpack here in terms of lessons and things for reporters to do better. But I think what reporters need to remember here is how to use polls. I think people use polls to be predictive when there are temperature checks of the moment in which they were taken. And too many political reporters look at polls and don't necessarily look at who commissioned the poll or whether that particular pollster released their methodology. And so scrutinizing polling better, not necessarily buying a narrative if it does seem like it's being pushed by partisan actors, particularly in the closing weeks of this election. We saw a lot of Republican-funded polls coming out. And also, this is one of my biggest criticisms of media right now, is just how willing we were, and a lot of outlets were, to buy some of these. I'm thinking of debates about, literally about a debate, for example, in Arizona, where Katie Hobbs wasn't going to debate Carrie Lake, and how many people put so much weight into, like, they're not debating. Or in Pennsylvania with John Fetterman and his stroke, how many people in political journalism were willing to buy that narrative.
The narrative that he was disabled and therefore...
this ableism. Mm-hmm.
And it's like you're creating the headlines, you're creating the fire, and then you're like, oh, whoops, actually, we're going to put the fire out. Mm-hmm. So Maya, you know, let me ask you this, because one of the things that was very interesting to me was that basically there is a conversation now about people leaving the Republican Party, you know, breaking from Trump. Mm. I focused on newspapers owned by the Murdochs, like the Wall Street Journal, the New York Post, putting out headlines criticizing him. So do you think that Republicans will finally leave Trump, turn away, or are you just getting ready to watch with fascination what happens over the next 2 years? Or is it fascination, or is it just kind of like, oh no?
I think it's more the fascination. You know, this is not the first time that conservative outlets have sort of started to suggest, in even more frank terms now, say Trump should not be the leader of the party, should not be the party's nominee. We did see on the Sunday shows a number of high-profile Republicans start to suggest that they would be very open to moving on, because I think a lot of Republicans, perhaps even a majority if you're talking to them privately, believe that the party does need a new leader in 2024. Trump had a really rough midterm cycle. He endorsed a lot of candidates who were low quality, who did not win, who might not have even made it out of their primaries, and now staring down a pretty rough midterm election cycle for his party, where the red wave that we all anticipated would come ended up being sort of a red ripple.
A red ripple. I love it.
A lot of Republicans are pointing their fingers at Trump, saying that he has scared a lot of people in the electorate, that they can tie the Dobbs decision to the Supreme Court justices that he nominated.
Yeah.
And I think Republicans are feeling like they have to move in a different direction. Now, whether or not, though, that attitude holds is a really big question, because even while Republican leaders might suggest and signal that they are ready for a new leader in 2024, Donald Trump still has the overwhelming support and admiration of the Republican base. So until that changes, I think it's going to be a lot of whispers and mealy-mouthedness. But we'll see.
Man, you're just dropping. I love the imagery.
That's a great word.
I think I just made up a word there.
No.
We'll take it.
Hello, my name is Jessica Rivasa. I am a third-year medical student. I'm a Georgia resident, but I'm doing my rotations in South Florida. So I voted blue down the ticket. I voted for Stacey Abrams and Reverend Warnock. And one of the things that is at the forefront is obviously how voting and politicians can affect medicine in general. One of the main things that I can think about when I'm talking about this issue is how it impacts my education. So because I'm practicing in the Southeast, where abortion is very restricted,
a lot of the people that are going to be teaching me are more hesitant. And so my education when it comes to how to perform these procedures or how to assist individuals who are dealing with this topic is severely impacted in a negative way compared to my colleagues who are getting an education in states that abortion is legal. Places like the state of Georgia, I think 80 counties or more do not have an OBGYN, so it's up to family physicians to be able to provide that kind of care. And I would like to become a family medicine doctor. So just thinking about how that impacts my education now and then in the future and my ability to serve my patients is one of the bigger things that I am voting for.
So listen, before we let you two fabulous guests wrap up, we're going to move on to our final segment, which we call La Última y Nos Vamos, the last one before you go.
All right, so we've heard from our listeners about their top concerns, and you both have been talking to voters on the ground throughout this cycle. Wherever I've been going, I've been talking to voters, Julio too. So now that we're on the other side of this election, you know, for me, the headline was democracy won, right? And also that you can talk about saving democracy and reproductive rights in the same conversation as a campaign issue. What are the issues that you're kind of like thinking about that have just stuck with you? Yeah, like chicle, like gum. We're going to start with you, Christian. What has stuck with you?
Yeah, what stuck with me, I think it is the complexity of how people thought of the state of the economy, really, because it was a big thing. If you look at some of the exit polls, people were frustrated with the economy, frustrated with Joe Biden. But then there was some diversity and some interesting results when you looked at people who described that they were being severely hurt by inflation versus moderately hurt by inflation versus not really being hurt by inflation. And it was in not really and moderately being hurt by inflation that Democrats did very well, actually. Surprisingly. And then severely, obviously, those people voted more likely for Republicans. And that despite all of that, people said, yeah, gas prices are hurting me. Yeah, inflation is bad. But actually, is that as bad as potentially losing a right? And that was, it just sticks with me how much like Secretary of State candidates did very well too. And in some places ran ahead of other statewide Democrats. And so a Secretary of State race, like you can talk about inflation, but it comes down to like voting there.
When was the last time you brought up national conversations about Secretary of State in American politics? Think about that.
True.
I love that. I love that. Maya, what's your final take? What's something that has stuck to you like chicle, like gum?
Yeah, Christian's was mine, actually. No!
You can expand.
Oh my
yes,
God.
Please.
Political nerds unite.
Please expand.
I'll shift. What really has stuck with me on top of that is what a great night Joe Biden had that literally nobody yes. anticipated. That the man who everyone was preparing to see sort of start to be ushered on his way out yeah. at the end of what was expected to be a party shellacking is actually pretty comfortably positioned now to run for a second term and has had one of the most successful midterm cycles of any president.
In American history, right?
Mm-hmm.
Exactly. So that has really stuck with me.
All right.
And the fact that he's just a good president, his approval ratings are not through the roof. So if the country voted like this, that says a lot in terms of where the country could be going, signals a lot yeah. for the Republican Party and the MAGA wing.
Oh, yeah.
And I think we're all hinging on, as always, Latino, Latina voters, Black voters, voters that are considered non-traditional, where are they? I really want to thank the both of you for bringing the high level of
yeah.
political nerdiness to our conversation. It was beautiful.
Thank you.
Maya King, politics reporter for the New York Times. Christian Paz, senior politics reporter for Vox. Thank you so much for joining Julio and me on this special Latino USA and In the Thick collaboration post-election Woo! Roundtable.
Thank you
so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Maria Hinojosa.
And I'm Julio Ricardo Varela.
Remember, dear listener, go to Apple Podcasts to rate and review us. You can listen to Latino USA and In the Thick on all major podcast platforms. Check us out on the web at latinousa.org and inthethick.org. Follow us on Twitter and on Instagram at latinousa and at In the Thick Show. Like us on Facebook and tell your friends and family to listen. This episode was produced by Alejandra Salazar, Noor Saudi, and Harsha Nahata with help from Elizabeth Loenthal Torres and Daniela Tello Garzon. It was edited by Andrea Lopez Cruzado and Mick Nick Spike, Julia Caruso, Gabriela Baez, and JJ Carubin. The rest of the Latino USA team includes Marta Martinez, Daisy Contreras, Mike Sargent, Julieta Martinelli, Victoria Estrada, Reynaldo Leaños Jr., Patricia Zulbarán, and Julia Rocha, with help from Raul Perez. Our editorial director is Fernanda Santos. Our director of engineering is Stephanie LeBeau. Our marketing manager is Luis Luna. The music you heard is courtesy of Nacional Kept and ZZK Records. Our Latino USA theme music was composed by Zenia Rubinos. Dear listener, remember, no te vayas. See you on our next episode. Ciao.
Peace out, y'all. We need to come up with a new election Futuro Media song. Like, you know how NBC Correct. Does the... This call, yeah. You got to come up with that. That's going to be 2024. Anyway.
Please. Absolutely. We need our own.
The opinions expressed by the guests and contributors in this podcast are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of Futuro Media or its employees.